Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The vote on John Roberts as the 17th Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court comes on Thursday. The full Senate is expected to vote at that time. It's been interesting to notice over the last several days how the editorial boards of America's leading newspaper and media outlets have responded to the confirmation. We have a split opinion. For instance, illustrated by the fact that the Washington Post has released an energetic and rather surprisingly enthusiastic endorsement of John Roberts, while the New York Times has come to the opposite conclusion. I'm reading to you from the Washington Post editorial. John Roberts, Jr. should be confirmed as Chief Justice of the United States. He is overwhelmingly well-qualified, possesses an unusually keen legal mind, and practices a collegiality of the type an effective Chief Justice must have. He shows every sign of commitment to restraint and impartiality. Nominees of comparable quality have, after rigorous hearings, been confirmed nearly unanimously. We hope Judge Roberts will similarly be approved by a large bipartisan vote. That's a surprise, frankly, coming from the Washington Post, because it is predictably pro-abortion on the liberal side of the political equation. And this tells us something, at least, of how they either perceive Judge Roberts or the political context. And my guess is it's more the latter. The New York Times responds very differently in an editorial that was published just yesterday. They say that Judge Roberts is simply too much of a mystery. I'm reading to you from the first sentence. John Roberts failed to live up to the worst fears of his critics in his confirmation hearings last week, but in many important areas where senators wanted to be reassured that he would be a careful guardian of Americans' rights, he refused to give any solid indication of his legal approach. That makes it difficult to decide whether he should be confirmed. Skipping down, but the unknowns about Mr. Roberts' views remain troubling, especially since he is being nominated not merely to the Supreme Court, but to be Chief Justice. That position is too important to entrust to an enigma, which is what Mr. Roberts remains. Now, let me make a couple of observations about the New York Times editorial here. In what sense could we possibly say that Judge John G. Roberts Jr. is an enigma? That can only refer to the specific questions he refused to answer in the course of his Senate confirmation hearings before the Committee on the Judiciary. What questions did Judge Roberts refuse to answer? Questions specifically about his interpretation of a supposed right to privacy, which the Supreme Court has found to exist within the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. He specifically refused to answer questions about Roe v. Wade and about other sensitive issues. Now, that does not an enigma make. We need to recognize that the way this whole process works before the Senate Judiciary Committee is that judges are asked questions that should supposedly center in their judicial philosophy. That should be what is at stake in the confirmation question, not how a judge would rule. One of the most important things that John Roberts said in the midst of his answers to questions posed by senators was this. He said, I am not running for office. A judge must not trade votes for decisions. That is absolutely clear. And on the fundamental issue of judicial philosophy, it's clear that Judge John Roberts is a conservative. His very language about a humble role for the judiciary, his metaphor of the judge as an umpire rather than a player or a coach, all this points to a very restrained and conservative understanding of the judiciary. Now, folks on the right and the left, both pro-abortion and pro-life forces, are going to be asking some very serious questions when the cases start to come to the Supreme Court with Judge John Roberts as the Chief Justice. We're going to be looking closely, but I think there's very good reason to believe that this is not only a good nomination, but a nomination that holds great promise for this country. And I look forward to Thursday, when I hope it will be an overwhelming vote for the confirmation of Judge John Roberts as the 17th Chief Justice of the United States. The Brave New World that Aldous Huxley and other novelists and prophetic writers warned about in the 20th century has come upon us much more quickly than could have been imagined. A couple of news stories from over the weekend that caught my attention. First of all, we have a report that an American hospital medical center, the Cleveland Clinic, well known for its pioneering work in heart research, is now planning an experimental program in human face transplantation. That's right, the transplantation of a human face. Researchers at the University of Louisville pondered this several weeks and months ago, but put it off because of ethical concerns. But evidently the Cleveland Clinic is not deterred by those same concerns. And the ethical concerns about the possibility of human face transplants are simply huge. Let's just think about a couple of these. Number one, there is the medical risk. After all, this is a form of transplantation that by its very nature is experimental. It's never been tried before. Let's remember that one of the main problems with human tissue transplants or organ transplants is the likelihood of rejection. The body's autoimmune system kicks in and rejects that which is foreign as if it is a virus or a bacterium to be opposed and defeated. That's the real problem in terms of the early rejection of heart transplants and of other organs ranging from just about any tissue in the body. What happens if a face is rejected, an entire face? You know, what kind of recovery is there? What kind of fallback is there from this kind of position? The issue of informed consent comes in. This is one of the hallmarks of modern medical ethics. This is why when you have even minor procedures done, you have to sign saying that you have been informed and thus you have given informed consent. You have to do this if you're having your tonsils out or your child's tonsils out. You have to do this if you're having virtually any minor surgical operation. Officials at the Cleveland Clinic admitted that there is no knowledge base adequate concerning this surgery to come close to being able to give informed consent. They don't know what they would have to warn against. They don't know what kind of complications may ensue. They don't know what kind of hope there is for a surgical success in this case. There are other issues, aren't there? Let's say this surgery is successful. What does this say about human identity? What does this say about how such a procedure could be used for nefarious purposes? After all, literature is replete with persons who have tried to change their identity. Let's imagine you could do it by a face transplant. Whose face is it? What would a person look like? How much is our identity tied to the specific contours of our face? It's interesting, isn't it, that you have all these new technologies that are using methods of face recognition software and all the rest. It's interesting that even as those things are developing, now you have the Cleveland Clinic announcing that it will attempt a human face transplant. We'll be watching this closely with you as well. Obviously, the concerns there are many. Also, on the Brave New World Watch that I dealt with on my blog at Albert Mohler, MOHLER.com, over the weekend, from Great Britain, there is the report that there is now going to be an offshore artificial insemination ship. You know, several months ago, we talked about the fact that given the restrictive laws on abortion in countries such as Ireland and Italy, not to mention some Pacific Rim countries, that there were pro-abortion groups that wanted to take ships in order to get offshore these countries and then to have ferries going out so that they could skirt the local laws and take advantage of the law of the seas. Now, given some of the restrictions on the use of artificial insemination and the whole thing with sperm banks and the rest in Great Britain, there is an effort by some to suggest that what is needed is an offshore artificial insemination clinic. Can you imagine such a thing? This is like something out of science fiction, but it is a real prospect. And The Guardian, one of Britain's most significant newspapers, broke this, suggesting that fertility ships where British couples will be able to receive treatment forbidden in the UK could soon be anchored off the coast in international waters. Entrepreneurs are planning to hire ships to offer treatments that include inseminations by sperm from anonymous donors or more controversial techniques such as gender selection. Folks, this is a reminder to us of the entrepreneurial nature of much of this biomedical and reproductive research. There is a profit motive here. It is always couched in the ethics and in the motivation of helping persons. But this is really about money. After all, these are entrepreneurs who are behind it. There is a business incentive, a capital incentive, a profit incentive, and we need to call this what it is. Folks, another interesting story over the weekend. I found this very interesting at Boundless Webzine. Grace Dyke talked about her college experience when she started taking classes in family studies, thinking that it would be about, well, for instance, how to have a family, how to improve family life, how to stabilize and enhance family life. One would think that academic programs packaged as family studies would at least encourage persons to honor the family. The exact opposite of what she found, she writes at the webzine Boundless, saying that she believes this kind of antipathy toward the family lies at the root of the attack on gender roles. What does Grace Dyke want to be? What is she now as a married woman? She is a stay-at-home mom. And that is the very role that most of these family studies programs are designed to disincentivize, to lead women no longer to want. Grace Dyke overcame this, but she's right about the ideological bias the commitment of those in these programs. Folks, when you see family studies in the academic world, don't assume this means strengthening the family. In so many cases, it is an ideologically driven program to undermine the traditional family, what we call the nuclear family, and especially to undermine anything like the traditional roles of mom and dad, husband and wife, parents and children that we from a Christian worldview have learned, as instructed by the Bible, to honor. Folks, when we come back, we're going to be talking about a frightening and startling new study out by the Centers for Disease Control having to do with teenage sex. We're going to be looking at the fact that there are some who take encouragement from these high rates of sexual activity, suggesting that this means that our teenagers are growing more sexually confident. Is that the kind of confidence you're looking for? We'll be right back to talk about it. Coast to Coast, this is the Albert Mohler Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Well, our government's done another study. Every time something like this comes out, you just wonder how in the world to brace yourself to get ready for what's coming. In this case, it's coming from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a think tank within that center known as the National Center for Health Statistics. It is a massive study on the sexual behaviors of Americans aged 15 to 44. That's a pretty broad spectrum. But the most interesting data is not coming from the adults, but from the teenagers. And I'm just going to give you a couple of the salient points. Let me tell you that it is difficult to talk about this, just given even the way this scientific report is written, without being offensive and using some language and talking about some concepts that are difficult on family radio. But just let me tell you right up front, here are the two things you need to know. Number one, it's suggesting that the rates of teenage sexual activity are still unbelievably high. But most specifically, it is suggesting that half of all teens aged 15 to 19 have engaged in oral sex. And the weird thing about this is that the immediate response to that statistic, when you just look at the media coverage, is that this reflects sexually confident teenagers. They're confident enough to make their decisions. They're confident enough to know what they want. They're confident enough for both girls and boys to demand equal treatment. And, folks, I'm really troubled by this. I'm afraid to talk about it, but I'm more afraid not to talk about it. As both a father and as a theologian, just trying to look at this, I have to tell you, there are grave issues raised by this. But if you just go into Google and you just put in teen sex study, sexual confidence, you'll just notice, you don't even have to go to the pages. Just look at what comes in terms of the printout, because you will see commentator after commentator picking up on this. Some of the language is coming from a man who is named James Woodward Wagner. James Wagner, who's president of Advocates for Youth, a reproductive health organization in Washington, D.C. I guess he's been picked up by so many media outlets because of the quotable nature of what he had to say. About abstinence, he said this: the abstinence only chickens are coming home to roost. And he's talking about this oral sex statistic, suggesting that what's happened is that abstinence only sex education has successfully convinced many teenagers not to have sexual intercourse, but instead they're having oral sex. And he sees that as a lamentable outcome of abstinence-based sexual education. This same man also said, this is James Wagner of Advocates for Youth, he also said that this points out the sexual confidence of especially young teenage girls. Is sexual confidence what we as parents want? Are we supposed to respond to this as a society by saying this is good news? I wonder what you think about this. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. The big issue is this: do we really believe in sexual abstinence, and are we communicating to our teenagers that that means no sexual contact, no sexual acts, or are we simply saying no sexual intercourse, and are they just redefining that to mean whatever they want to mean? These statistics tell us that an awful lot of teenagers are saying that they're not having sex, that they're practicing sexual abstinence, but that doesn't mean they're not having sexual activity. We're living in a brave new world when it comes to biomedical ethics, but we're living in a weird new world and a dangerous new world when it comes to sexual ethics. And all you have to do is look at a study like this from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. After all, this is not coming from Playboy. This is not coming from some liberal, ideologically driven think tank. This is coming from our federal government. Not that that means it's free of ideology, but it is telling us that this is coming with a massive tax-supported research project behind us. And this does tell us that this is something we need to take with significance. I'm going to be writing about this. You'll see details and links on this on my weblog tonight about how you can find out more information. But right now, I want to know what you're thinking. How are you as parents responding to this? Are you alarmed that there would be people who would suggest that the bottom line in all this with boys and girls and oral sex and all the rest means that we're raising teenagers who are more sexually confident? I just can't imagine that that is something that we should brag about as a society. What do you think about abstinence-based sex education? Are you buying the argument that this just means that teenagers will find other means of sexual fulfillment? All kinds of issues going on here. Virginity, technical virginity, secondary virginity. And, of course, what you have with the technical virginity is that they're having sexual activity short of intercourse, and they're still calling it virginity. The world seems to have changed a whole lot just in the last several years. We have to watch the vocabulary, even as we read this kind of research report, and make sure we know what we're talking about. The specificity in this research really puts it right in our face. What we're talking about here are very active, that is, very sexually active teenagers. Half of them, half, reporting that they've had oral sex during those teenage years. And then the vast majority suggesting they've been engaging in other sexual behaviors as well. Again, the phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Are we fighting a losing war here? Does this research just tell us that there's no way to persuade teenagers not to be sexually active? Well, let's think about the glass half full here. This does tell us that half of all teenagers aren't engaging in oral sex. That's good news. That's not good enough, but it is a reminder that when someone says everybody's doing it, well, it's not everybody, but it's far too many. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Time magazine has an interesting spin on this. They call it the teen twist on sex. The interesting thing is how they really go at the gender equality here. The girls demanding as much from the boys as the boys are demanding from the girls. Has feminism as an ideology so warped our society that we say that that's progress? Instead of both boys and girls reclaiming something like chastity, what we have are the girls saying we can be just as demanding as the boys. We're living in a weird, weird world, very strange times, and times that require Christians to think carefully, to think clearly, and to be ready to talk about what really matters, because the world's out there talking about it. Time magazine's talking about it. All you have to do is look at the web pages, and you'll see the newspapers are talking about it. The sex ed experts are talking about it. That's disastrous news. James Wagner's talking about it, the president of Advocates for Youth. He says the abstinence-only sex education chickens are coming home to roost. That's what explains the oral sex statistics. And then there are others who are saying, look, when it comes down to the equality between boys and girls, that just shows that these young girls are becoming more sexually confident. I just have to respond to that with moral revulsion. And not only that, with parental concern. What does that say about our children? How does this redefine childhood and adolescence? Is this now the time of socially sanctioned and officially encouraged sexual experimentation? Are we really conveying to our young people the idea that anything short of sexual intercourse isn't sex? Are we really defaulting to this kind of model of what some are calling technical virginity? I'm afraid that maybe some of us are sending mixed messages. I'm afraid that some parents failing to talk about this aren't getting the point across. I think there's some churches that maybe are also complicit in this confusion. I'd love to hear from those of you out there who have teenagers as children or work with youth in churches. I'd like to know how you would think of addressing this. When you look at this kind of research, when you're faced with these statistics, how do you think to respond? Just to let the world talk about this. And that's the problem. Being a Christian, especially being a Christian adult, especially being a parent, especially being a Christian leader, means in this time you've got to talk about things that are sometimes uncomfortable. They're just too important to miss. You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program.
the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back, America. I know there are a lot of folks out there that are going to be reading this report and putting their own spin on it. Some of the spin is that this is good news, sexually confident teenagers. Others are going to say this is moral disaster. I hope it awakens a lot of parents and church leaders to what we really face in terms of a responsibility to address these issues from a comprehensive, biblical, and Christian worldview. I don't think kids are going to make the right decisions. I don't think they're going to aim for sexual purity if we don't tell them what it is and why it is that it is so important, not just to their moral lives, but to their spiritual lives, to their marriages, and to their ability to show God's glory in the totality of who God made them to be. Let's go to Phil, calling from Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, listening to WHKW. Phil, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dr. Mohler. Often listener, first-time caller. I just wanted to share with you that I think it's a little bit irresponsible to blame this. It is a tragedy solely on the fact that we're pushing abstinence in the schools, teaching it. I think you can't forget the fact that there is this predatory pornography that incites these kids also and excites them, not to mention how our society handled the whole Clinton scandal back in the 90s and basically said it was okay to have this type of activity. So I think, again, there's a combination of things that these kids are dealing with. And to just solely say that abstinence, teaching that as the sole reason for this tragedy is a little bit irresponsible.
Well, I think it's more than irresponsible. I agree with that, of course, Phil. I think it's worse than that. I think it's ideologically driven by people who don't want kids to practice sexual abstinence. And so what they're saying here is really, to me, beside the point. In other words, what the problem is evidently with the definition of abstinence, because if they're having oral sex, they're not practicing sexual abstinence, not in any way I believe that we as Christians would accept. And, frankly, all I have to say is not in any way I think my parents would have accepted when I was a teenager. That's a whole new thing. But, Phil, you're right. When it comes down to this, blaming sexual abstinence, much less abstinence-based sex education, is just a dodge. It just shows you that those who are opposed to abstinence-based sex education will jump on something like this in order to suggest, I guess, it'd be better if the teens weren't avoiding sexual intercourse. That's the weird nature of all this. Appreciate your call, Phil. We're going to go to Tommy calling from Indiana, listening on WFAA. Tommy, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much. You know, as a youth minister at a small church here in Indiana, you know, I've discovered that the teens have something, you know, around these parts that they're calling friends with benefits now. So, I mean, it's not just, you know, just two teens together. It's a lot of teens, you know, active all together. And it's really, you know, it really surprises me because, you know, when I was growing up, you know, sure, we thought about it and thought about it hard, but yet we knew the morals. And even if you throw scripture at these kids nowadays, they're saying, well, that doesn't apply to me now. That was just for those people in the Bible.
Yeah, that's certainly one of the challenges we face. And that's where we have to have a comprehensive recovery of biblical teaching in the church. It can't just be what the youth minister says on Sunday night or Wednesday night to the kids. It has to be what the church, as the body of Christ, says comprehensively in terms of what's said from the pulpit, in terms of what is taught at home. That's the most determinative thing in many ways. And the kind of messages we send by how we honor marriage and fidelity and chastity. Yeah, we're really up against it. This term, friends with benefits, FWB, this refers to sexual benefits. And so if you as parents come across that term, it doesn't mean financial benefits. It doesn't just mean emotional benefits. It means sexual benefits. And FWBs, friends with benefits, they're kids who are giving each other sexual favors as the very basis of the friendship. And, of course, it's difficult to talk about, but what Tommy was hinting at there, it's true. You have some early adolescent, middle adolescent, and late adolescent parties that bring these kids together, and there are some games that are played that would simply curdle the milk if mom and dad understood what was going on. Of course, that is our responsibility, isn't it, to understand? Ignorance is no excuse. Parents aren't called merely to sit back and wait for reports of bad behavior or of sexual immorality to come to them. It's our responsibility to raise our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. It's our responsibility to raise little boys to grow up, to be faithful young men who are ready to be faithful, God-honoring husbands. We have to raise our girls not just to grow up into their adulthood as sexually confident young women, but to aim for the biblical model of womanhood to be the holy role of wife and to fulfill the role of mother. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. There are some out there who no doubt think we are just out of step and out of time. Give us a call and tell us what you think. Coast to Coast, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. There's a lot in this study we can't even talk about, and you can rest assured that your federal government is at work counting statistics on things that you undoubtedly would blush even to read. But the really troubling stuff has to do with the teenagers. Not that the adult behaviors aren't scary enough, but when it comes to teenagers, we know their unique vulnerability, and we know by definition that these are behaviors that are not connected to marriage, and there's the big problem. We're talking about friends with benefits, technical virginity, and of course this statistic that fully 50% are engaging in oral sex and not calling it sex. That is the troubling stuff. By the way, a researcher responding to this said, quote, "What's happening is that our definition of sexual behavior has broadened." Well, that's something of an understatement when you read this report. So we have some commentators saying, look, here's some partial good news. We're raising a generation of sexually confident teenagers. We have others saying the problem is abstinence-based sex education. And we have others who are suggesting that this just means that the definitions are broadening. Give me a break. I really want to know what you think. I'd love to hear from more parents out there, those who work with teenagers, in terms of how you're handling this, how you're teaching your own kids, and how you respond to this kind of research. This is going to dominate at least part of our conversation in terms of the culture over the next several days. I think you're going to be hearing about it. Time Magazine's giving it major attention. The network news programs, the cable news programs are all talking about it. And I think there are going to be a lot of folks engaged in discussion about this. This is your opportunity for intelligent Christian conversation. The phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Ken calling from Cleveland, listening on WHKW. Ken, it's your turn.
Hello, Dr. Mueller. It's good to listen to your program. You bring up a lot of great points that we should, as parents, should be concerned about and as Christians. The children being more daring and confident with sex, I think that's a small percentage of the problem. I think a bigger percentage is there's no fear anymore. There's no fear factor. You see it on the backs of pickup truck windshields, no fear. They don't fear anybody. And these kids are not afraid of the consequences because there aren't any consequences anymore for things they do, and not just sexual misconduct. Everything they do, there's no consequences. We as parents don't discipline them anymore the way we should. And now it's becoming almost impossible for us to discipline them because we have some parents that are trying to eliminate spanking your children.
Ken, I didn't mean to cut you off there. We're coming from a remote location, so what we have in the case of Ken is a man with a lot of common sense calling in, and I appreciate Ken both your passion and the kind of biblically grounded common sense you're bringing to this. The no consequences thing is really huge, and Ken, I want to say to you and others listening that there is a perverse angle to this that is embedded in this research. There are those who are arguing that the kids understand just from the physical and reproductive dimensions that there are fewer consequences to oral sex than to sexual intercourse. And so there are some who are saying, look, these sexually confident and very wise teenagers are understanding that you eliminate the risk of pregnancy and that you can eliminate all kinds of other risks by engaging in oral sex rather than in sexual intercourse. Of course, without going into detail, there are other risks you also bring into your life through that. But, you know, this just tells me again that the only risk that some people in our society, the only consequences they fear would be something like pregnancy or a sexually transmitted disease. There are no moral consequences involved here that are even on the screen. What about the damage to a child's life? What about a damage to this individual's prospects for marriage? What about a warped soul? What about the price, the consequence of sinning against a holy God? That's just off the horizon. Ken, I really appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in from Cleveland. Let's go to Matt calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Listen on WFIA. Matt, you're up.
Hey, Dr. Mueller. I was a youth minister in Florida the past couple of years before I came to Louisville to go to seminary. And your issue of youth ministers dealing with this problem, I just really struggled because just bringing up the issue to parents and students is I was already felt like I was treading on thin ground. But to go to the step of having to define and oral sex and whatever is really a scary issue. So I think you're right in saying that we need to take a step further as a church and say, look, we have to deal with these things honestly because the world is dealing with them.
Now, Matt, you are a minister of youth, and I appreciate you calling. I gave just on the air kind of a special invitation for ministers of youth and parents to call. But I want to ask you a question, Matt. Do you think that one of the issues we now face is that youth ministers are failing to minister to the parents of youth? You see, I think that's the missing link here. I think one of the things that we need are churches to have really candid, honest, gut-level, biblical conversations with parents about these issues, honoring the parents' role to be the direct persons to talk to their own teenagers about this. Do you see the same problem?
Yes, sir. I think that is an issue. I think candid would be probably the best word to describe it. It's an issue where there's a nervousness as a youth minister that really honestly shouldn't be there, that we should be able to approach parents and say, look, this is what your kids are facing, and you've got to deal with it as parents. And there needs to be a stronger partnership in our churches between youth ministers and parents. I believe you're right.
Matt, a lot of common sense there. I really appreciate your call, and I appreciate your honesty in saying from your own experience as a youth minister, this is tough. It isn't easy. You know, frankly, it's not easy to talk about on the air. It's not easy to talk about with other parents, much less when you have to talk about it with teenagers as well. But, hey, who said parenting was going to be easy? Very quickly, we're going to go to Amy, also calling from Ohio. Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I just wanted to say that this is worrying me as a parent and just as an American. I feel that we're going as a society, we're following straight after Europe. And I say that, I just had an example. My husband, when we were married, we were both virgins, and he was telling me about how his mother, who is a wonderful woman, she's not a Christian, and how they have such a different mindset. She actually asked one of his girlfriend, if she would try to seduce him because she was worried that he didn't have any sexual experience, and she saw that as abnormal. And I'm just like, I know that like sounds like an incredible story, but it's true, and it's a lot how a lot of people, when we've been over there, how they think. And I'm afraid that that's just the way we're going, and it scares me.
Amy, God bless you with that call. I appreciate, again, your passion and insight there. I have to tell you that that mom bears no resemblance to my mom. That was not the kind of experience I had. I don't think that's the kind of model that most of the moms and dads listening to this program want. But, folks, if you're not talking about this, you're really failing. And what does it say? You know, I've talked on this program before about the number of parenting books for teenagers, these books suggesting people how to parent them, who suggest, for instance, putting out a cookie jar of condoms on the kitchen counter just so your teenage son or daughter, for that matter, can grab them whenever they're going out on a date. What kind of signal does that send? I think we know what it sends. I'll be right back with some final thoughts in just a moment. I'm Albert Mueller. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. This has been a fascinating discussion. I hope it is a catalyst for discussions that need to take place in families and in churches all over America. This CDC report from the National Center for Health Statistics, it's not only a wake-up call for sex educators, those who are the professionals out there in the sex education industry. I say that with a snarl. But it is for the sex educators that really matter, parents. Parents and those who help parents in the local church to get ready for this responsibility. Final thoughts. Let's go to Luke, listening on WFIA-FM. Luke, it's your turn.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I don't think that we're fighting a losing battle. I think it's more that we're just starting to come to grips with the fact that in our society, everybody has access to information and, you know, they develop at a much higher rate. And I think that needs to be addressed as parents are thinking about teaching their kids. Because I know that my parents were working with the past generation when they try to teach me. You know, I'm a 23-year-old, just got married, and I felt kind of on my own a lot of times for the fact that there's so much out there for me to access. And my parents didn't have any experience with that in the past. So.
Yeah, well, Luke, thanks for your call. Another honest man. And that ought to be a wake-up call to parents. Parents, if you don't know what your kids are reading, what they're hearing, if you don't know what their friends are talking about, if you don't know about the movies they're going to, the internet sites, and all the rest, you just have no idea what you're up against. And don't think you can just sequester them away where they're safe and isolated from all discussion or all temptations about sexuality. Not hardly. That is impossible. We need to raise a generation that are thoroughly grounded in biblical truth, a generation transformed by the grace of God, confronted with the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, a generation raised to aspire to Christian manhood and womanhood and to the holy covenant of marriage, a generation taught not to fear their sex drive, but to respect it, a generation taught that what God honors and offers is far higher and to be esteemed and enjoyed more than what the world offers and its perverse and carnal understanding of sexuality. Folks, if what we offer is just a dim, pale version of what the world talks about in sex, then we should not be surprised when our kids are attracted to the more vibrant and seemingly more exciting version offered by the secular world. We need to understand that God's gift of sexuality in the context of marriage, lived out according to his principles, is far more exciting, far more fulfilling, and far more exhilarating than what the secular world could ever know. In the covenant of marriage, we come as close as possible in our sexual selves to being naked and not ashamed, to showing the glory of God and receiving all of God's good gifts. Folks, you'll be looking at this report and other things in the media. Just remember, we know the truth. We need to tell not only the children, but our entire world, the truth about sex and why it matters. I'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation, live today from Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Albert Mohler.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.